Welcome to the Internet Advisor Podcast. I'm your host and producer, Foster Brown. Along with my co-host, Gary Baker, and our team of experts, we've been helping people like you since 1998 with your computer problems, introducing you to valuable resources, and promoting tech enterprise throughout Michigan. The Internet Advisor is a two-hour podcast recorded every week at the studios of historic WJR Radio in Detroit. Both hours of the show are available each week on this podcast and are streamed to our affiliates across the state of Michigan. We're also proud to be part of Detroit's newest and fastest-growing podcast network, PodcastDetroit.com. And now, here are your hosts with this week's Internet Advisor.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor, your place for answers to your computer questions since 1998, with your co-hosts Gary Baker and Foster Brown and their team of tech experts. The door is always open at InternetAdvisor.net, on Facebook, and through Twitter. But right now it's time to get you in touch with your helpful hosts on this week's edition of Internet Advisor.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor. Hi, Foster Brown. On this beautiful long weekend, Black Friday's gone by. For those of you listening to us a little later on, it's heading towards past Cyber Monday and into a great weekend. We've got a lot to talk about today. Richard Steenen, our security expert, is going to be with us. We'll be learning about a new way of making sure you're safe online. All that coming up on the Internet Advisor.
Back to the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
Welcome back again, as I said before, to the Internet Advisor. Hi, I'm Foster Brown, co-host of the program, and everybody is back in studio looking stuffed from a busy holiday weekend, I would guess. For some of you, it's a vague memory. But for those of you listening to our podcast in the beginning of the week of Cyber Monday, good to have you along with us as well. My co-host down in warm and, I imagine, sunny Florida, Gary Baker, is with us. Hi, Gary. How you doing?
I am doing well, and it is sunny here.
It is. All right.
Yeah.
Well, tell me, what was your first warm Thanksgiving like when you were down there?
Well, it was bumpy. Because we took off on Thursday morning, on Thanksgiving morning, and went across the Gulf Stream to Bimini.
Oh, yes.
And the Gulf Stream, even though it was early, was a little bumpy. And while we're up a couple stories on the flybridge, we were getting splashed. Water was coming up over the bow, and we had a kind of really fun, adventurous, fun for some of us, adventurous activity. And then we dove on a wreck, and we had all sorts of fun.
Oh, sounds good. Was that?
Ate conch instead of turkey. We actually did have turkey dinner later in the day, but we had to eat our share of conch first.
Conch. What is conch? Conch is a shellfish, isn't it?
That's right. You know, the big shells,
yes. Where
you can pick them up and hear the ocean.
Yep.
Those are conch shells.
I gotcha.
Bimini is famous for that, and we had to make sure that we tried some of the indigenous food, although you can get conch in a lot of places, but it's famous over there.
Speaking of indigenous foods, Ed, what was the indigenous food up in Deer Camp this year?
Let's see, Deer Camp, usually beef deer jerky, and we bought some, I made some Mexican lasagna.
Ooh.
Which was really, really good.
Ooh, yeah, exotic.
Yeah, well, use lasagna noodles, and you just make it like you throw chilies in there and beef, and you just smother it with enchilada sauce and more cheese.
And
it's a perfect warmer-upper.
Flamethrower, that's what it is.
you warm up the camp twice.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then throughout the rest of the evening, I would imagine. Cal Carson, it's good to have the bearded wonder back here.
It's great to be back after a short jaunt over to Kalamazoo, as I do once a year every November for the Kickoff Classic. And it was an enjoyable competition. Got to see a lot of my synchronized skating friends, because I do two types of skating.
Oh.
And it was good to see a lot of them, because they're from all over the country and stuff like that. And it was great to see them again. And as far as exotic cuisine on Thanksgiving, I started off about 5 o'clock in the morning having the illustrious donut and tea, because I was down with the rest of the family. We were working the Thanksgiving parade like we do every year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What did you do for the Thanksgiving parade?
Well, my daughter was, this year, she was a spotter for the floats. So she walks down Woodward and makes sure the floats don't run into people and stuff like that. My wife is a seamstress, so she always helps with the stitching of the costumes and that
kidding.
Sort of thing. And then I'm a dresser. So I work in the area when the people who volunteer to walk in the parade come in, and we dress them in the costumes and then get them down to makeup and then get them down to the buses so they get shuttled out to the marsh.
Makes you wonder if there's a category of undresser on the other end. I don't know.
Yes, there actually is. When they come back, if they need help getting out of their costumes, we help them with that too.
I don't know if you guys remember, but folks, if you're ever in Detroit, I don't know if they'll do it this year, but remember they had the heads on display.
You're talking about the big heads.
Yeah, the big heads are on display in the Fisher Building. I haven't seen them this year, but the parade was just earlier this week, so maybe we'll see it a little later on.
Yeah, they usually use them during the parade and for a couple other functions, and then sometimes, depending on, because you can book the big heads and have them come over to your party or whatever.
Oh, really?
Sort of Yeah, there's tons of stuff you can do at the parade company. It's just amazing.
Astounding. Well, guys, this is a big week in terms of news going on as well. Bitcoin, and Ed, you've been looking into, as a matter of fact, we're going to talk about a little more in depth later on in the
Bitcoin
show.
Bitcoin hit $8,200.
Something like that.
Per coin. It jumped up in 1 month. It was $5,000 a month ago, and now it's at $8,200.
Wow. How many of those coins do you have now, Ed?
I don't have a single Bitcoin, and I wish I did when they were $25.
Oh, my, yes.
So. But how long will they stay that way? You know,
that's a good question.
Bitcoins are just like the stock market, right? They can go up and down in value, or they stay up in value.
They could. I mean, they've been climbing, and everyone's wondering when they're going to burst.
Right. When's the bubble going to pop?
Right. The value has already dropped several times. In the last month, it dropped 20%. From when it was climbing from 5,000 to 8,200. And I guess a lot of people, you know, that may use it as an investment, they may have lost out. You know, I don't know. We'll talk about it later.
Yep, we'll be talking about that. Another thing happened was matter of fact, in the second hour, we're going to be talking with Richard Steen, who's coming back to visit with us, and we're delighted to have him here. He's one of our security experts and been a favorite for many years. Richard, we're going to talk with him about the whole Uber deal. Did you see that this last week?
Yeah,
about
Uber.
Not only did they lose all that data, initially at least, but then they got together and, it sounds like, colluded with the hackers.
Yep. They paid him off to return the data and promise not to use it or sell it. Yeah.
What do you think about that, guys? Does that embolden them, or is that an effective way of dealing with the ransomware kind of thing?
You got to notify your customers and your clientele that there was a breach.
That didn't happen, though.
That did not happen.
They sat on that information for a long time.
I think they all do that, because if you've noticed, you've noticed every major breach that comes out, to go like, you know, it's December. Oh, there was a breach with such and such. When did they discover it? Oh, back in July.
Yeah.
Now they're just telling everybody, you know, to give them enough time to either figure out what the story is going to be, or if they're nefarious, you know, well, we got to get all our stock sold so that, you know, we can get the maximum money before it falls through the floor after they find out there was a breach.
Right, exactly.
So, I don't know. You just kind of hope like heck your data's not in it and deal with it one day.
Oh, it's in there. I'm sure my data's been stolen, you know, 20 times at least. You know, how many times I'm issued new credit cards thrice a year by all my banks. And
really?
I don't even ask. It's done this the second year in a row that I've been reissued cards.
Wow, I have not had.
Chase and MasterCard, I mean, all of them.
Bank of America's where I bank, and it's not happened to me. Gary, we've got about 60 seconds here. What are your thoughts on this whole Uber thing?
So if you're going to, first of all, somebody that just cheated you and held you for ransom, and now you're going to make a deal with them, you're going to give them 100 $100,000, and you're going to trust them?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Very trustworthy. And by the way, you don't even know who they are.
You know, Gary, if you give me $100,000, I'll become real honest with you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like it was ransomware.
And oh, by the way, guess what? I need another 100 just to make sure I keep it from somebody. And maybe another 100. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not like it's the ransomware model in which they actually encrypt your data and then hold it captive for until you pay the ransom. That wasn't the case at all this time.
Mm.
And despite that, it's illegal to do that.
Yeah.
So
it's all illegal.
I broke all sorts of laws by negotiating with them and not informing the public.
You kind of wonder, you know, what the final blow will be for Uber. They seem to be committing harikiri or suicide on a regular basis. Hey, we'll be back in just a minute with a gentleman who has helped to develop a brand new way of helping to make sure that we are secure online. Back in just a minute to do that here as the Internet Advisor continues.
Now back to the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
You know, security is a huge concern, and we're constantly looking for ways of making sure that our conversations and our transactions are safe online. And a group of people who have been working on a new aspect of this has developed something called a voice authentication. VAuth, I believe, is the name of the title. In any case, Robert Capps is with us. He's the authentication strategist and VP for New Data Security. And Robert, thank you so much for joining us here.
Oh, thanks for having me. New Data Security does use technologies to continuously authenticate users. And the VAuth system is actually pretty cool. I believe it came out of the University of Michigan. And what they were doing was building wearable technology that could continuously authenticate that the wearer is the right human that needs to do some sort of online or non-in-person transaction. And because that device is with him and constantly listening to conversation and voice patterns and speech patterns, it could actually make sure that token is always with the person it belongs to, and therefore to be used for stronger authentication of a user when they're trying to assert their identity online.
Okay, good. Well, then let's see if we can straighten things out here, because what is the relationship then between New Data and this technology?
New Data produces technology that uses inputs such as this VAuth technology and other sorts of physical and passive biometric verification. So looking at what someone's doing, when they're doing it, how they're doing it, measuring their physical biometrics and some of the more passive perceived biometrics. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of this procedure, this technology with the VAuth that it kind of, if I understand, it's kind of, I imagine a parrot sitting on somebody's shoulder listening to them talking and you know, imitating the sound of their voice or, you know, the cadence of their speech. That's essentially what this is. It's a device that's you carry with you that is constantly being updated with the information of what your voice sounds like.
Yeah, so it learns your patterns of speech and other sorts of things to verify that you're still physically present within its sphere of influence, right? As far as it can hear. We're just hoping it's not like a parrot so that it doesn't repeat what it's saying. But because that can open a whole can of worms for security. But you know, really the sort of technology that we're talking about here is key to helping consumers control their identity, control their ability to interact in non-face-to-face ways. Because as we've seen over the last year, and even in the last week, we've got even more data breaches on the wires with Uber and other companies stepping forward and saying they've lost consumer data. We've gotten to the point now where if you have a pulse and you've ever done an electronic transaction, whether logged into a website or done a credit card transaction, your data has probably been stolen in some way, shape, or form. And so we have to find new ways for consumers to be able to assert their data, assert their identities, in provable ways, because what we have today, what we've been using, is no longer sufficient.
So basically what you're saying, it's a, the way I interpret this is you have an application that's on the phone, and it's basically during the initial setup, you go through some security passwords and stuff, but then you're basically, you've given this application a token, and it uses, as long as you're speaking and your patterns are the same, you're constantly validating the token for this authenticator of application, so that when you open up a web browser or do a purchase transaction, you've been authenticated and that token is still valid. Something along those lines.
Right. So it's along those lines. It's basically taking the friction out of doing a physical biometric verification. You know, we have a lot of different ways of authenticating users, whether it's an iris print, it's a selfie, a facial recognition. We've got fingerprint readers on most major phones that are produced these days. But all of those take the consumer doing something extra to authenticate. And what things like this VAuth product and what things like New Data Security, where we're passively identifying what's going on with this consumer, we can passively strongly authenticate them in ways that would normally cause friction to the customer experience.
Robert Capps is our guest here. I'm sorry, hang on a second, Gary. This is Robert Capps, who's the authentication strategist and VP for New Data Security. Go ahead, Gary. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just curious, though, Robert. How is this going to learn my speech patterns? Is it done over time? Like, does it know on Friday night I go out to the bar, so it'll recognize it when I my speech when I slur, you know, things like that? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, so typically products that learn consumer behavior and consumer interaction do observe variability in those interactions based upon, you know, condition, based upon situation, based upon health. You know, heart rates can be used to identify someone, but probably won't be 100% on if you've been running a marathon.
Yeah, right.
Unless that's normal for you. You know, and voice, people get colds.
Yes.
Facial recognition, you know, you up there in Michigan, you know, people do like to play hockey here and there. You take a puck to the face and you're probably not going to recognize 100% yourself with facial recognition. You know, human bodies change and over time and they get injured and they do all, you know, all kinds of things like get drunk or what have you. Systems need to be tolerant of that, right? Because the humans are always going to be a little, they're going to do the same thing differently every single time. And you have to assume, you have to account for that in whatever systems are in place. So with a voice recognition system like this, if you really, really got hammered at the bars one Friday night, it probably would not recognize you. You know, a lot of technology would start to fail in those sort of situations. And then we run into backup technologies that add friction to the transaction. Maybe they
actually,
send
that
an SMS to your phone to make sure you're the right person or something to that effect.
Yeah, I'm thinking that would be a good thing. I wouldn't want me to use that technology if I were in that condition. So I'd say things like that.
Yeah, I think some people should put that in front of their text messages on those Friday nights at the bar.
Yes, that might be a good deterrent, another way to keep people sober. Go ahead, Cal.
Is this technology adaptable? Also, is this technology also adaptable, like, for just a straight-on computer where you're not using a phone on a regular basis, but you could, you know, hook a microphone to the computer?
Yeah, I mean, technology, you know, whatever modality that technology is baked into, I know that the VAuth guys have talked about, you know, pendants around your neck or a watch or something that you would wear and is persistently on you. That's cool. That's a convenience form factor. Those sort of technologies are portable to almost any modality, whether that's a phone or a tablet or a laptop or even a desktop computer. You know, we have things like Amazon Alexa and, Siri and these other products that do similar sorts of things with voice recognition and text to speech and speech to text and you know, integration to search engines, things like that. You know, that technology, the whole voice technology stuff is going to be, I think it's going to be baked in everybody's lives to move forward, from the car to their phone, the wristwatch, to their computers, even the microwave.
So it's not going to be one particular technology, but rather a whole host of these things that are put together.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a layered solution. When it comes to consumer authentication and technology, we really do have to look at all the tools in our toolbox. There's no silver bullet here. There are products that work really well in one case but probably fall down in another, and they have to be bolstered with something else.
Is there a possibility that you could set up some sort of sensor that would read your DNA so it has even more uniqueness?
Didn't we have a movie about this at some point in the 90s? I mean, in theory, you could do any number of verifications from a physical characteristic, and, you know, nothing gets more physical characteristic than the chemistry that makes up your body in DNA. So, those things are all theoretically possible, of course.
Let's talk about new data, your company, and talk about the kind of things that you do. What is the scope of your focus as a company in security?
So our focus is making sure the right human is getting to their account and not someone that has their username and password and it's been stolen in a data breach or something like that. And we do that through a number of different techniques, from what you have to how you use it to what you are and how you interact with the technology that interacts with the websites. And we can uniquely identify reoccurring good customers, really, really accurate type of detection without the customers doing anything other than opening up their web browser and going to the bank or their retail site they want to go to and putting in their username and password. From there, we can get to very accurate human identification.
That is really remarkable. I can't help but think that the kind of approach that you're taking is kind of a holistic approach to this. Am I right in characterizing it that way?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the more data we can take in about consumer behavior and their habits and things like that, even through systems like we were talking about with this always present voice authentication, those sort of inputs work really well in a framework like ours to identify and to authenticate those users with as little friction as possible. You know, we save the friction for the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. We want them to have the hard time handling this. Well, our guest has been Robert Capps, who's the authentication strategist and a VP of New Data Security. And I just got to say, there is a picture on our homepage at internetadvisor.net, which shows the device that I believe they developed at the University of Michigan, which is kind of interesting because, Google Glasses may not be as out of en vogue as they used to be, you know, because this thing looks pretty strange. It's got a device that has been strapped onto one of the stems of a pair of glasses, and apparently it sits there and reads the voice activation and tone, et cetera.
It's really funny because it looks like something Rudell would have built.
Robert, hey, thank you so much for being with us, Robert. I appreciate your work, and it's a fascinating project. Thanks so much again for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a minute to talk a little bit about net neutrality, a big battle coming up pretty soon, and see where maybe you stand on it.
Now back to the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
And welcome once again to the Internet Advisor. As the young lady said there, it's good to have you with us on our podcast. And by the way, don't forget that we are open to your questions. We may not have the open lines going while we're preempted by MSU football, for instance, or some other programming here during the winter months on WJR, our flagship station, but we still have the ability to answer your questions. And matter of fact, we're going to have one this coming hour. And Cal, as a matter of fact, had a special offer for people who brought questions in this month. We'll talk about that a little later on, as a matter of fact, as we get closer to the second hour. With us right now, however, we've got Gary Baker online from Fort Lauderdale, where he's down on the shared adventure, and Cal Carson in studio, along with Ed Rudell and myself. And guys, this last week, the battle, I think, in some ways has been joined. I mean, maybe I'm being too dramatic with that, but the Trump administration, their appointee to the FCC, Commissioner Ajit Pai, announced that I think it's on December the 17th, they're going to hold hearings at that point on doing away with something called net neutrality, which has been a big battleground, was a number of years ago, if you remember. I think it was about 2015 that it was a real, people were locking horns over that. So what exactly is net neutrality? That's, I want to see if we could take a little snap of the, you know, snatch of the program here and talk about that to for a certain extent. Gary, would you like to kick off talking about what net neutrality is, perhaps, and what the battle is about? Gary?
There's actually, there's no really good right answer here. Net neutrality is about treating every single stream of data in the same way, so that ISPs can't say that they are going to favor one kind of data over another. All data should be treated equally. It's basically, if you think of a system of first in, first out, or first there gets the access, that would be net neutrality. So ISPs can't pick winners or losers. And obviously, you don't want some ISP to say, I've got a special deal with this kind of a company, so I'm going to give them favorable treatment, right?
Sure. Or if
however, on the other side of that, the people that say, look, email should not be treated the same way that streaming media should. Mm-hmm. Email is a store and serve type of resource, a system. So what if it's interrupted momentarily, just a small blip, it's not a big deal, right? It'll get there in 4 seconds instead of 3.5.
And for instance, I don't think I read my email the second it arrives. Most often it's been sitting there for a while.
Right.
That's right.
And the same thing was loading web pages too. Do you really need to have it there in a quarter second, or will 1 second be adequate for standard web page draws? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is that argument, yes.
Yes. But your streaming media, which we all have more and more access to and want more and more often, you want that to be always on. You don't want it to buffer because it's waiting for some email traffic to traverse the net instead of the stream of real-time media. And that's really the flip side. And that's why I say there's no really good right answer. Both sides are right. Both sides could be abused,
been abused.
Right? And have been, but have they been abused to the detriment of the users?
Well, you know, Gary, you speak a lot of free market and that sort of thing and competition. Why don't ISPs just offer the choice? You know, if I pay extra $5, they'll give me a net neutral stream, where if I pay the standard rate, I don't get a net neutral stream.
And that, Cal, may be the answer, right? If you want streaming media, you're just going to have to pay for it.
Right.
The user will just have to pay for it.
Well, yes, but there's also the other flip side, and who monitors this, in that when voice over IP was first coming up and you had companies like Vonage that were coming up, and you had someone in the South, I think it was South Carolina, was actually blocking or causing slowness and not delaying the packets for voice over IP. Well, because they were offering, this cable company was offering their own voice over IP.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
And the FCC got involved with that, lawsuits were filed, and it was proven, and lots of things happened. Same thing happened with Comcast and Netflix.
Go ahead.
So there's a history.
So Ed, maybe the value, or maybe the answer then, is segment the types of media. That you're able to offer streaming media with what they call zero, with quality, it's called quality of service. So with zero latency in your quality of service. But for other types of media, maybe a little bit of latency is okay.
Right.
But you treat all types of media the same. So therefore, Vonage is the same type of media that a Bell system, streaming phone conversation system, would be the same. So you'd have to treat both of them the same way. But you could treat email differently. Right. And maybe that's really the answer.
Guys, how about the commentary, essentially, Ajit Pai, who is the FCC commissioner who's in charge now.
Formerly of Verizon.
Right. Interesting, yeah. But his comment was that essentially we're going to stop the government from micromanaging this particular industry.
Right.
And that has to do with the classification of the broadband providers, am I right? That they're being treated like the telephone companies?
Or
utilities.
Or utilities,
right.
Yeah.
I think that's what the term was, right, Gary?
That's right.
And I forgot that there's a class, it's been so long since I've read
like
it.
Like a common carrier clause, I believe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what happens. I think it's going to go through. And if negative things happen and it can be proven in the next year or two, maybe the government will have to review this again. If things start going, hitting the wall. You know, all they're going to do is repeal an act that the Obama administration put in place. And actually, it sounds like the Obama administration at the time did an end run by using this common clause thing. But that was the only legal way that they could throw it up there.
Because otherwise it was being thrown out of court.
Otherwise it's going to be thrown out of court. And maybe something maybe they will classify them as truly as utilities at some point in the future if, things start hitting the wall, if you will.
Hmm.
But, it's not going to be the end of the world come December 18th whatever the date is.
Exactly.
And that's going to be the same. We'll see what happens over the next few years. It's not going to be the end of the world. A lot of conspiracy theorists think that all of a sudden all those switches are going to be flicked and their Netflix is going to crash and they'll no longer be able to use Hulu properly because Hulu is a competitor and, my internet service provider provides on-demand service, so I'm going to throttle Hulu. This is all speculation. I don't think that's going to happen.
Have any of you experienced throttling, what you think is throttling?
Only from my cell phone company and my data.
Well, here's a good question for Gary, because he was in the business at one time and another. Can I buy raw internet from someone as a normal consumer and don't have to buy it from Comcast?
Well, of course, there's lots of places, and it depends on what level, right? There are a number of backbone providers. Then there are a number of interim, what's called interconnect providers. And then there's the last mile providers, right?
Do they?
And now we're starting to see that last mile doesn't matter because we're going to wireless. So at some point, these companies that have invested in last mile technology, is that as big a deal as it used to be? Maybe not.
Do they sell at a competitive price, same as like Comcast or UVerse or those other guys, or do you have to spend gugobs of money and put a switch in your house?
Well, it depends on, again, where you are. If you're in a populated area, there's a fair number of choices today. If you're halfway between the U.S. and the Bahamas, and there's only one provider out there that you can get internet service from. Speaking as the voice of experience just recently, you don't have much option.
I'm remembering a conversation with Charlie Hopper. We didn't have the time to hook up with him right now, but remember Charlie talking about the fact that he had he found himself competing with AT&T, which had sold him the connection to the internet to start with.
Right.
And that they were going back then to his customers and saying, hey, we got a cheaper deal for you.
Right. Yep. Yes. I remember that.
Yep.
So he put all that time and effort.
As a guy that's always been in favor of small business over big business.
Yeah.
You don't want to see small businesses run out of business because of, the economy of scale of a large provider who can reduce the price for a significantly long length of time in order for them to run the small business, out of business, create, a price point for the consumer that is way below. And the consumer benefits from that, by the way, for some period of time.
Yeah.
And then without any competition, then they're allowed to raise prices.
Well, the other thing, too,
we've seen, though, is that when they start raising their prices again, new technology comes on the market.
That's exactly it. And one of the things that I really liked about what Charlie was doing up there in the Upper Peninsula, by the way, he runs Pasty.net and Pasty.com, which are in the Keweenaw Peninsula area. This is like about as far as you can get from the in Michigan. You can't get much further in the tip of that. And
a 12-hour drive and you're still in Michigan.
That's exactly it. And he is incredibly creative, and that's what I've always loved about what Charlie does up there. Well, folks, in just a moment, we'll be back with Mr. Mike Brennan talking about the headlines that he's got for us at MI Tech News. All that coming up on the Internet Advisor.
Now back to the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
Well, it's that time of the program once again to welcome Mr. Mike Brennan, the editor of MI Tech News, a great source of information about what's going on in technology and entrepreneurship in our fair state of Michigan. And thank you, Mike, so much for joining us here on a holiday weekend.
Hey, great. Always a pleasure. Thanks, Foster.
Yes, sir. Let's talk about some of the headlines that I've seen you put together, although I should say that this Friday, some of you who are used to receiving the headlines from MI Tech News, Mike very reasonably took the weekend off, and we've got headlines that were posted on Wednesday. So let's see, Mike, let's talk about one you've got down here. As a matter of fact, this was a one of your video links, which I found kind of interesting, and maybe you could talk more about it. It's a cutting the cord with Cloud Tech One's satellite-based high-speed internet connections.
Now, as a disclaimer, Rick Becker is the CEO there, and I are business partners, but it's still something I want to talk about because I think it's a great deal for business. And it's not necessarily your primary internet, but since everything is connected to the internet these days, sometimes stuff happens, right?
Yep.
You could have a truck hit a utility pole and knock out your AT&T or Comcast service. Well, in that case, that's what this would be. The satellite service XEXEDE service that Rick now is reselling provides that backup at very reasonable prices. You can get to 1 month of service from the satellite plus 10 gigabytes of data for about $169 a month, and it's metered, so you only, if you need it, then you charge additional above and beyond whatever it is you got. But if not, then, you know, it's just there as a backup in case you need it.
You know, this is kind of like, it was interesting, you're answering a question that I think that Cal asked during the last hour, which is, you know, is there a way of being able to buy your own direct connect, if you will, to the backbone or to a much higher speed internet? I believe Cal had asked that question this last hour.
Yeah, this is really fast. This is a 100 megabytes service, so it's really fast. I had DirecTV for a long time, so I asked Rick about that. I said, you know, if you get storms, what happens? He goes, satellites are a lot more powerful, and better technology now, so the weather is really not a factor, at least for satellite internet service. I can't speak for DirecTV or anything like
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm. Right. The other thing, though, is that now that's the down speeds, right? The up speeds
yeah.
are still pretty slow because you're going through a landline for that, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't quote you a number because I don't have that right in front of me. But, yeah, it's certainly not a 100 megabyte service.
No,
but,
no.
But probably in the 15 or 20 range, I would think, somewhere in that ballpark.
Okay, very good. Great alternative. All right, another one I saw here, and this is was kind of fascinating to me. I didn't know we had space technology companies in the state of Michigan, but Orbio Space Technology is just won $500,000 from Accelerate Michigan's innovation competition.
No, well, not only are they from Michigan, but they're from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Ooh.
This is a technology spin-out from a Michigan Technological University professor. It's an interesting product. It helps to propel small satellites into space at a less expensive cost than what it is now. I mean, putting something in space is very expensive, but he's figured out a way to do it for a lot less. And as a result, he's been awarded with $500,000 in cash, not the Brinks truck pulling it, but I think it was a big check. and then another 39,000 in in-kind services from, you know, lawyers and accountants and all the rest, you know. So
that's really cool.
And interesting, and I'd never heard of it either. When they won, I looked it up, and I went, really? I never would have guessed.
So this was a spinoff from, what's the?
Michigan Technological University.
MTU.
That's where all the engineers, that's where a lot of engineers are. It's a big engineering school. It's like Lawrence Tech, except it's bigger than Lawrence Tech, you know, so.
It's a huge place up there. All right, well, let's see. A third one, and this is a lady that we've known and had on the air here on our program, The Internet Advisor, and that is Amanda Lawan. She's the co-founder of Bamboo Detroit, and she was on with you recently on the M Squared TechCast, am I right?
Came on and talked about a report that she had. I don't know if they did it themselves or had it done. I forgot to ask that question. But they looked at Bamboo members. They did the survey, and that it turns out Bamboo members as a group generate revenue of $74 million
a
year.
That's wonderful. Yeah, but explain Bamboo Detroit for folks who may not be aware of it, because the name doesn't immediately tell you what it's about, although bamboo is one of the fastest growing plants in the animal and the plant world.
That's why Amanda picked it. Go fast, grow strong, all that jazz. That's her little model thing going.
Yeah.
It's a co-working space. So it's a floor. It actually got two floors now in a building in downtown Detroit, not far from the book Cadillac. And it's in there. You go in and you can rent a desk. You can rent a room. You can lease office space. I mean, it's designed for keeping your operational costs, overhead, and all that jazz down really low when you're starting out business, particularly if you're a one man or one woman band and you don't want to incur all those extra fees. But I think its beginning cost is $150 a month to use the facility, to have office box there and all that other jazz. And the real upside is there's 250 members, something like that, and they all work together. I mean, they all do something, right, that you can probably use in your business at some point. So you build all those relationships, and then you get this essentially virtual corporation.
And what Bamboo does is they're an incubator.
They
help businesses,
Not
just software developers, but lots and lots of other different.
I meant more in the sense.
They may not be associated with each other, except they all have similar problems, i.e. Learning how to start and run and grow a business.
Exactly.
And
they're drawing on one another's talents as well, and they're very different talents. That was more what struck me about this, is people coming from different disciplines, different approaches, and each contributing from their perspective. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, Tech Town, too, does that. Tech Town on a bigger scale. They have like 400 or so clients. But they have a lot of lifestyle businesses in there. Only maybe a quarter or so are technology-based.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's similar. There's all those around the city.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being with us and for sharing these headlines. Again, folks, if you want to have these headlines delivered to you on a regular basis, all you need to do is to go to mitechnews.com. And once you get there, simply put in your email address, and it will cost you nothing, and you'll get this service delivered to you on a regular basis. Mike, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Foster. Always great to be on the show. I even talked to Captain Gary down there in Florida.
Take care of yourself. All right. We're coming back in our second hour. We're going to be back with Richard Steen, and we're going to be talking about cybersecurity with a wonderful expert.
You're listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor Show. To see the show notes for this program, visit our homepage, theinternetadvisor.net. You'll discover past podcasts, our free toolkit with software to clean up your computer and keep it running strong, and many other resources. You'll also find links to mitechnews.com, our co-sponsored weekly tech and entrepreneur newsletter, edited by Mike Brennan. If you have a question for our hosts, just click the contact button on the homepage and send us an email with the details. And don't forget to look for us on Facebook and Twitter and at Detroit's newest podcast network, PodcastDetroit.com. Now, let's get back to the second hour of The Internet Advisor. Us on Facebook and Twitter. Don't forget to check the other great podcasts available on this PodcastDetroit.com network. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor, your place for answers to your computer questions since 1998, with your co-hosts Gary Baker and Foster Brown and their team of tech experts. The door is always open at InternetAdvisor.net, on Facebook, and through Twitter. But right now it's time to get you in touch with your helpful hosts on this week's edition of Internet Advisor.
Hello, this is Foster Brown, co-host of the program, along with my posse. We'll introduce them to you for this second hour of the show, and we're going to be meeting an old friend of ours. Richard Steening is coming in. He's a cybersecurity expert, and we'll be talking with him about some of the new companies that have popped up and see if the cybersecurity suite you're using is up to par. All that coming up this hour of the Internet Advisor. Let me add one person to that list. That's Mr. Cal Carson, who is also here with us today. And that's Edward L. Cal Carson and Gary Baker. And we've got quite an hour coming up here. We're going to be looking at Internet security here in just a moment with Mr. Richard Steen, an old friend of ours who's on board with us for this next hour. He had a position which didn't allow him to be with us on as regular a basis as we have in the past, and we're delighted that he is now able to be with us, although I think it entailed changing his employment opportunities. We'll maybe catch up with that with him in just a little bit. But right now, guys, welcome aboard. Good to have you on.
I didn't realize it. You know, I've listened to that lead in for years now and never realized that I'm not on it. And maybe I need to send her a check.
We need to.
You didn't pay her, Cal, when the rest of us did?
You didn't tell me that I had to send her a check, but I have a really nice turkey and a couple of goats I'm sure I can send her.
Or parts thereof after the holiday.
Oh, I'm still enjoying the holiday meal. I tell you, most people by this time are like, no, I don't want anything to do with it. I'm still like going whole hog. I can't get enough turkey, dressing, macaroni and cheese, green beans, ham, and all the other stuff that goes with it.
There's still room in the fridge, huh?
Going away really fast because my daughter's in the house, and she's like going through it like a whirlwind.
Ed, you've got a family home as well, I understand, right now.
Yeah, he spends more time sleeping than anything, you know, and then shopping, and then, oh, can you pick me up some stuff? And, you know, so I just blew another...
Going to be graduating very soon from Grand Valley.
Yeah, he decided to stay another extra semester so he could get a double bachelor's. He only needed like two more classes to get a double bachelor's, so he decided to...
Now, the daughter did not come home, though.
Well, she's in London still. She's over there getting her master's.
So what did she have for Thanksgiving dinner?
Oh, I haven't spoken to her since that happened.
Rather.
I'm sure it's like bangers and whatever.
Mashes and bangers, yeah. I don't think there's an equivalent of a Thanksgiving in Great Britain.
Charles Dickens had
But they have Black
turkey.
Friday over there, too. They do have Black Friday sales over there. So, you know, I think the world eats turkey now.
Better than eating crow. Hey, by the way, some things that have happened. We mentioned this in the beginning of the program, and I wanted you, Ed, if you could, to try to fill us in, and maybe Gary, you can, with your financial background, help us with this as well. But Bitcoin did an incredible jump this last week, didn't it?
It's almost like it's a stock. Is what a lot of people are viewing it as. You know, several months ago in the summer, it was worth $3,200 per Bitcoin, $5,000 at the beginning of October. Now in November, it's $8,200 per Bitcoin. And a lot of people, and even some companies that are doing futures, are speculating on this. So you have Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which is now doing Bitcoin futures.
Wow.
You also have Square, which is owned by Twitter, which will, on a limited basis, is going to be accepting Bitcoin currency in pilot form and allow people to exchange cash for Bitcoin and vice versa, or allow the people to pay for products with Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
So, and Square is the little things you could stick on the top of the iPad Android for small business to do simple transactions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, crafters have it and
it's a
small
credit
businesses.
Card reader.
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
You know, you also have the CEO, JP Morgan Chase, was basically commenting on it and talking about possibly being used as in the futures market as well. So a lot of people are looking at it, but they're also speculating that when's this bubble going to burst?
Yeah, and there are now, Gary. There are other crypto. They call them cryptocurrencies, I believe. Like Ethereum is one of the ones that I've heard
about. Yeah, there's Litecoin,
as well.
Ethereum, Dragon Chain, which actually I think is backed by Disney. And let's see what else.
All I know is that if people are interested in investing in a Bitcoin type situation, I can get them in contact with a new one. It's called Calvinadium, and just send me the money.
Calvinadium.
Yes, and I'll make sure that it'll grow in value. Now, I guarantee
you. Should see the bills.
Ultimatium.
Gary, you've been involved in the financial world for quite a while as well. What's your reading on Bitcoin and where it's going?
Well, it's fluctuated so much. It's garnered a whole lot of attention, right?
Yeah.
However, I'd really love to either see, and this is where I differ a little bit from Ed, if it were a real company, there would be something. Whether it's really of that value or not, but there would be something behind it.
Yeah,
there would be an income stream from advertising. There would be actual physical product or something, right?
Yeah, there's nothing behind this.
There's no income stream. There's nothing. Right. So this acts very similar to, say, a currency. So then when you think of, okay, so what currency would you invest in? Would you invest in currency in a very highly inflationary country?
Like, pound or...
Or would you... That goes up and down 20% in a day. Or would you invest in the U.S. dollar or the euro or the yen or something that's backed by a government that's pretty stable and will be here for... and be able to pay off, make good on the investment.
Right.
And... so when I look at Bitcoin, and nobody knows who created it, it was created by a mystical character.
Oh, yes.
Who wants to be, anonymous.
Uh-huh.
Has it grown? Yes. Are people interested in it? Yes. Would somebody take a flyer in it to make a little bit of money? Yes. Would somebody bet their life savings? God, I hope not. I don't know.
That's true.
And would it be the first shady thing that Wall Street has backed?
That's a great point.
Do they ever get caught holding the last Bitcoin that's going to go to zero value because somebody all of a sudden figures out how to print a gazillion more and they become next to worthless?
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I'm not going to be the last person holding one.
Right, and I'm not sure if I want to be the one that's speculating. I'm not in favor of Bitcoin. I'm just amazed at how someone could generate this to circumvent banking institutions and create not a commodity. People want it, therefore they get it, and they're willing to sell automobiles for a coin or for a percentage of Bitcoins, houses. All sorts of retail items.
It was used in the black market as well for drugs at one point.
I can see this actually coming to fruition, probably out of China or something like that, where they have their own versions.
A
growing economy, and they've got tons of money flowing in there.
Yeah, but like Gary said, this isn't based on anything. It's not based on commodities. It's just based on the rarity of Bitcoins.
Well, guys, I'm going to be interesting in terms of security to talk with our guest Richard Steenen, who's coming up in just a moment. He has been with us many times in the past, and we're delighted to have him back with us again. Richard Steenen coming up, talking about some of the new security companies that have popped up. All that coming up here on this hour of the Internet Advisor.
Now back to the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
It's been kind of funny trying to keep the conversation from working itself out off the air. So Gary Baker is, I know, anxious to talk with our guest, Richard Steenen, about the subject of Bitcoin, among other things. But Richard, first of all, I want to welcome you back to the Internet Advisor. It's a delight having you with us.
Yeah, it feels like a new era. It's
wonderful. Yes, it has been. Now, you have, of course, you continue to maintain your relationship with IT Harvest, am I right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay, which is an organization that you started. But recently, you stepped out of a role that you were holding with Blanco, I believe. And yep. We now have the opportunity to talk a little more freely with you. And so I'm delighted that you could be with us here on our program on this holiday weekend. It's good to have you here.
Yeah. Oh, it's great to be here. Great to be a free agent again.
Let's talk for a little bit at the beginning of this, because it's a conversation we started just a little bit ago. Gary, you were saying that in offline that in the past, you and Richard have had conversations about subjects like Bitcoin. So let's maybe, Richard, you could start off by giving us some of your opinion of what do you think Bitcoin is, and is it something we need to keep our eye on, or is it going to be just kind of a fad when the bubble bursts?
Well, I'm reminded that Gary and I, you know, participated in a land rush. It wasn't a gold rush at the time, but a land rush, jumping on the internet, competed in a friendly manner way back in the day, the mid-90s.
And Bitcoin and crypto. We met because we were competitors, and we've had some great conversations. Right,
yeah, totally. We work together too, and Bitcoin has the same feel of, or you know, cryptocurrencies in general, as you know, land rush and literally a gold rush. Right, people are going after the money. I'm afraid, you know, for Gary and I, it's too late to jump on this train. Other than as investors, right? You could speculate completely. When Bitcoin hit $2,000 a coin, I was like, no way would I invest now, right? Because it was 12 months before that, it was like at $2. You're not going to invest in it. And of course, at $3,000, you say the same thing. And at $5,000, $7,000, we're coming up on $9,000, I think, coming up quick.
Yep.
You know, so, and, you know, you don't want to be the stupid person who jumps in at $12,000 because, of course, that's when it goes to $1,000. But, man, there are some... there's some people out there, my sons included, who bought it when it was pennies per Bitcoin. And, you know, it was a significant financial benefit to them. And I've met people that are Bitcoin millionaires. It's quite cool to see. So I'm a huge proponent of cryptocurrencies, right? The idea that you could have a relatively frictionless transaction ability online. So if I want to pay somebody some money, I can do it without a PayPal taking 3.5% to 7.5% of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how do you deal with what Gary was talking about before, that essentially there's nothing to back it? There's no you know, Fort Knox.
Yeah, but,
go ahead.
Yeah, but there's math to back it. So this week somebody, and the math is solid, this week somebody published a report that there are 39 countries that use less power per annum than is used to generate Bitcoins.
So it's their own rarity in the generation or the mining of Bitcoins, right, using computer power. It's their own rarity that is the commodity. It's not,
right.
It's not any currency or gold or commodities. It's just the rarity that it, and the time it takes to create a Bitcoin in computer power.
Yep.
That's it.
Yeah. And you don't have the, you know, for the dollar, you've got the Federal Reserve, who since 2008 has just been, you know, pumping money into the banks. And they literally do that by changing numbers in a spreadsheet. They say, okay, bank, now you've got $10 billion instead of $9 billion. And the banks turn around and they buy treasury bills with it. You know, it's just, it never gets down into the economy. They don't loan money to anybody who's in the in small business knows you can't get a loan from a bank.
I'm not good much with math, but I don't take much comfort in hearing that what's behind Bitcoin is math. That's numbers, just numbers. Is there, you know, I guess maybe I'm naive enough to think that, for instance, in America, our currency is backed by something.
It's backed by the full faith of the government, but it doesn't. We're not on a gold standard anymore, so it's not really backed by anything, is it? It's just that everybody trusts that it's good.
Yeah, and it's the petrodollar of choice, right? So all of the world's resources are priced in U.S. dollars. So
soon to be Bitcoin. It sounds like
soon to be Bitcoin. Yeah.
You know, and I imagine banks are trying to come up with this and experimenting with this now. I mean, legitimate banks.
You know,
Sure. Banks are, plus, you know, the explosion of different types of coins and the amazing money that's been raised through initial coin offerings, ICOs. It's definitely in a bubble because everybody's trying to do one. My favorite out there is Steem, STEEM. And the idea is that you get some sort of coin credits whenever you comment on a post or create a post. So it's really meant to encourage content creators with good stuff, right? And the more, if you create good content, you'll get more Steem coins and eventually make money doing so.
Mm. Now, explain that to me. How does that work again? I'm curious. You create content? Yeah. Any kind of content?
You go to steem.io, I think it is, and it looks a lot like Medium, you know, the blogging site.
Mm-hmm.
And when you create a new post, you earn Steem somethings. And when people comment on it, they earn Steem credits for commenting and for liking and all the rest. So it's like encouraging social interaction like you do on Facebook, but you get something from it instead of Facebook getting everything.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right, Gary, your comments now.
I get the same when I fly Delta. I get frequent flyer miles.
Yeah. How's that working out for you?
I can exchange
them. You get the right to fly more on Delta.
I can exchange them for, you know, for more flights, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
so,
exactly.
You know, curious, what happens if somebody figures out an algorithm to create, clandestinely to create more bitcoins and start feeding them into the market all over the blockchain?
Isn't that called counterfeiting?
A little bit here, a little bit there.
Not possible. Can't be
done.
Well,
it's happened, right, in other currencies. So why wouldn't it happen in Bitcoin?
Yeah, because of the math. It's beautiful. That's like suggesting that somebody could all of a sudden crack all crypto, which, yes, there's a 0.0001% possibility of that happening. But the way it's laid out now, you just can't do it. So, Gary, you'll understand this. In order to recalculate the blockchain, and this is the race condition that goes on, you know, every few minutes in the blockchain world, is you have to take all the new transactions and calculate a new hash with a certain number of leading zeros.
Right.
And an MD5 hash, as you know, takes millions and millions of calculations in order to find something that matches a certain pattern. The Dooku or the Flame virus that the NSA created, they estimate cost $250,000 just to create that hash collision. That the Bitcoin miners that get rewarded for doing all that work, they get a Bitcoin every 10 minutes for doing it. They have to do all that math. That's why they need data centers full of computers crunching numbers, which is kind of wasteful. No question about it. There's a lot of energy being spent doing this.
Mm-hmm.
The power to do it, and then the heat, the power to cool the machines that are doing it.
Yeah.
But it is really, really hard to break into. Now, the problem is there's all this politics going on. There's a team of five developers who have complete control over, new additions that they might want to make to the whole algorithm, and there's politics involved. And And that's where the weakness is, the human element.
My understanding...
So how would somebody crack this? So how many... Why would there be a bubble burst? How could that happen?
But as soon as people go, whoa, this is overinflated, that's a bubble. That's how bubbles burst.
Right.
There's no market for it.
Yeah, I mean...
But the trouble is, there's so few Bitcoins, and it's so hard to generate new ones, that the philosophy is, the bubble can't burst. But whenever you say that, the bubble bursts.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
They just said it, so...
There's a fixed number of Bitcoins that could be generated every month, and the number is fixed at a maximum, and I forgot the number. Was it 40 million?
No.
42 million or 42,000? I forgot the exact number. I know it's a big discrepancy, but it's 42. So what's the answer to the ultimate question of the universe? It's 42. So I think they based that number sort of on that, which is kind of weird. But
and we know when that's going to happen, right?
Yeah, 2148, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so that leads to my theory. So the inventor of Bitcoin was Satoshi Nakamoto, and he published a paper, and boom, it just happened. So here's my theory. He's from the future, and he came from that year in the future when he needed this to be there. And he came back here, published the paper, and then he went back to the future. He's just enjoying whatever profits he got out of it.
I like it. I like that.
You and I both love science fiction.
Yeah, we're both science fiction guys.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just going to stick what I see here on Craigslist. It says free horse manure. Must be able to pick it up yourself.
So much of this does sound, I mean, like people talking gibberish. I'm sure there are a number of other people who, like me, have just kind of bottomed out a few minutes ago on the vocabulary that's being traded back and forth.
I am just upset with myself that 5 years ago, if not more, when I was sitting with a friend of ours, Jim Crenshaw from work, and he was telling us about this, and I didn't go out and buy a bunch of Bitcoins. That's what I'm upset about.
Well, you know, there'll be another one sooner or later. You just give it some time. Hopefully, you'll be around to see it.
You know, I missed.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back on the other side, we're going to continue this conversation with Richard Steenan, who is our guest here, along with our crew.
Back to the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
Let me reintroduce our very special guest, an old friend of ours, Mr. Richard Steenan, who is with us by the phone. And Richard, it's always good to talk with you. He's Chief Research Analyst at IT Harvest, also an author, a published author of There Will Be Cyber War and Up and to the Right and Surviving Cyber War, along with a book that you co-authored with Mike Brennan, Cyber Stiletto, as well, which is available, I believe. Is that still available on Amazon, Richard?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah? Okay, good. Look for them online there as well. We've been talking about Bitcoin, and I'm glad that we have somebody on here who is as enthusiastic about talking about this as Ed and I are curious about it as well.
Well, we're curious, and it's about cryptocurrency in general, but the first was Bitcoin, yes.
So you had a question, Ed, about...
Well, Richard touched on this a little bit ago, but a lot of startup companies are doing IPOs and they're somehow incorporating cryptocurrency or their own unique cryptocurrency into the initial public offering. And I didn't quite understand how that played out. Richard, could can you explain that?
So Ed, they're actually ICOs, initial coin offerings. So they go, hey, you know what? We're going to create a new coin, and it's going to have this difference from Bitcoin, and it'll be more stable or whatever. And they basically have the initial coin offering where you can buy the coins before they even spun this thing up. And so you get in on the ground floor for the next one, the next Ethereum.
Okay.
Yeah. And there have been some that have raised, I saw one number, $35 million in 15 minutes of launching. So,
interesting.
And of course, as soon as that happened, everybody, and I've been approached by at least four different people that said, we're going to fund us with an ICO. You know, and it's like, you know, Bitcoin is good for certain things, but it's way overkill for other things. People are coming up with, let's use Bitcoin as a identity management system. And it's just way too much, right? You don't need that for a lot of functions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're coming up with their own coin called an ICO. And when they get the money, they're actually using it for, is it exclusively for coin use? Or are they actually going to, development cost and for some product they're going to be selling millions of?
It's like a GoFundMe, but the product has the basis is going to be some sort of cryptocurrency that they just created.
Oh, okay. So this is just basically cryptocurrency. Okay.
Guys, this sound a little bit like Chuck E. Cheese coins? I mean, they have no value.
Well, actually, I guess they do have value because I was out on the net and I said, who accepts Bitcoin as payment? And some interesting people do, and some really strange people do. WordPress will take it.
Oh.
Overstock.com will take it. Subway will take it.
Very interesting.
Subway.
Eat Fresh. Microsoft Microsoft will take it.
Oh.
Virgin Galactic, which includes Virgin Mobile and Virgin Airlines, they'll take it. CheapAir.com will take it. Expedia will take it. Steam, the gaming platform.
Well, Steam's been taking it forever. Yeah. I remember that.
And then you got some strange ones like the Pumberry Tavern in London, England is a pub that will take it. The Pink Cow.
I was in a pub in Amsterdam that took it.
Yeah.
And people didn't have it, you had to go to an ATM and buy some first, and then you could go to the bar.
Yeah, there's a couple other weird ones, like the Pink Cow. It's a diner in Tokyo that takes it.
Yeah, you know, Gary probably could have got his boat down there for 50% off if he used Bitcoin.
Well, I should have used Bitcoin because it cost me other mucho dinero here.
Wait
a minute. Could I just have used pesos? Yeah. How's the difference? What does the exchange rate concept still work?
There's exchanges that will quote you a market price. Trouble is, you know, they're doing the arbitrage thing and they're charging you a percentage every single time, so it no longer becomes frictionless to start moving between Ethereum and Bitcoin, for instance.
And if Gary's really nervous, just let him know that yachtbase.com, a Croatian yacht charter company, also takes Bitcoin.
There you go.
Oh, dear.
I won't be taking Bitcoin anytime soon, just to let anybody know. Don't bring yours here.
Hey, Richard, one of the things I want to see if we could shift just a little bit from, and I've got to get to these new companies that you've seen on the line, you know, malware companies or for battling it, et cetera. But, Gary, you mentioned before blockchain. Could either of you or both of you give me some idea, anybody help me with what is blockchain?
I want to get what's the difference between, Gary tried to explain it, but wasn't blockchain also based on the same math that was used for the development of Bitcoin? Didn't they evolve at the same point? Okay.
Completely. Yeah, one and the same. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
That was misleading, Richard. They were developed at the same time, but blockchain is not a cryptocurrency.
Correct. Okay. But they use the same math.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's the technology behind Bitcoin. Right. And what Bitcoin was a open ledger. And the idea is, imagine a small community and, you know, some guy says, I'm going to start a bank, but I'm going to publish, make totally transparent every single transaction. Because, you know, if you dig into the weeds, right, a bank, you deposit your money and it disappears, right? If you deposited dollar bills, disappears into an account and they don't track the dollar bills anymore. They just track a number in your account. But it is totally dependent on your trust relationship with the bank and also the trust relationship with the federal government who issues the value of those dollars. Mm-hmm. The blockchain was just, hey, how can we publish all the time so everybody can see that that register of transactions. And then they just figured out how they can do it with cryptology to, you know, make sure that it wasn't, nobody could fool with it and change it inappropriately. And that was the birth.
Hmm. All right. Now, what I want to get to, Richard, is something that since you recently now, as you said before, kind of freed up to be able to make public comment on some of these things. When you surfaced again in public like this, one of the things that you saw were there were a number of companies that have appeared on the horizon, excuse me, companies like Polyverse and eSentire and Verodin. Talk about them as, and are they producing products that our listeners can go and go online and do they offer better protection than Avast and some of the other ones that are out there right now?
Yeah. So we're not there yet. You know, so if you're looking for better protection than the Avast of the world, you definitely have to look at Malwarebytes, for instance. To me, right now, if I had Windows, I would run Malwarebytes on top of Internet Essentials from Microsoft, and I'd be very, very confident that it's in pretty good shape. But what's the exciting parts are happening in this world of, okay, how do we counter these really sophisticated attackers, cyber criminals, nation states that are trying to do all these things to us? And one company, Polyverse, has got a really, really great solution. You know, they're selling it to enterprises right now, but I won't be surprised if eventually, you know, Microsoft starts reselling or incorporating some of the stuff they're doing. So, you know, every vulnerability in an operating system relies on knowing things about the memory stack and the location of where things are in memory, because you're trying to overflow memory and insert instructions and all this stuff. So one method of countering that is make sure that you use different OSs for different things. So if you were a smart person, you would use Linux for your servers, and you'd use, you know, Macintosh, this is for you, Cal, for your desktop activities.
Thank you.
Good move, good move.
And there's some things, and then you'd use Microsoft for Outlook and Microsoft Office 365. So, and that's great, because that means that a single worm or virus can attack all of your systems at once and won't spread as far. And this is the whole monoculture versus multiculture argument. So Polyverse says, okay, let's make every single machine a separate operating system. And they do that by just scrambling the memory addresses of all of the function calls. And there was a company like this that did this years ago called Santa Security. But they, you know, they did it for, they did it once, you know, so when you install your Linux server or your Windows server, it was scrambled at that time. And a attacker could eventually, you know, figure out a particular vulnerability in your system. But Polyverse changes it continuously. You know, it can be every few minutes.
Wow.
It can be a brand new machine. So you've only got a few minutes to figure out what's the zero day and can I attack it? And then boom, everything changes a few minutes later.
So, all right.
I love it.
You know what? In our first hour of the program, we talked with Robert Capps, who's with New Data Security. We were talking with him and getting his evaluation of this speech technology called VAuth, which has been developed by the University of Michigan. But the bottom line was that he was saying that, and maybe this is, see what you think of this, that the holistic approach, in other words, using many different kinds of ways of identifying somebody, is far more secure than saying, okay, I'm going to use only biometric, or I'm going to use only voice, or I'm going to use only whatever. But that the using a symphony of these different things is actually the most secure way of doing it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I could share a Gartner 101 lesson that we all learn. When a vendor says holistic, insert the word imaginary.
Right.
But, But agree. I mean, I certainly agree that you have to have layers of defense, and you have to look at, stopping an attacker at each layer, just like you do in a, fortified establishment, right? It's got to have walls and all the rest.
I really wanted to talk about and get Richard's opinion about if you use the blockchain, are you exposing all of your transactions to a lot of people? Does that mean our privacy goes out the window?
Because the blockchain is not anonymous, so you are, yeah.
Yeah, so privacy goes out the window.
Not totally, because you can have a private wallet, right? You don't, when you install a wallet, you don't give it who you are and your birth date and all the rest. So it's just that, when you buy something illicit, it's also you bought a subscription to the Wall Street Journal and they could figure out who you were because it's all there.
And GM, if they used it to transact business with a tier one, everybody will know that they're now working with that tier one.
Right. Yeah. Good point.
If I buy a house with it, using blockchain instead of a bank, then everybody knows what I paid for the house.
Yeah. Which is not necessarily a bad thing, is it? It's better than
I don't care about my privacy, but
yeah, it's better than the stupid numbers Zillow comes up with.
All right, Richard, hang on. We're going to wrap things up with you in just a minute. I want to talk about some of these other companies, eCentire and Verodin as well. Maybe you got some thoughts on them. Richard Steenen is our guest here. We're talking about cybersecurity with one of the world's great authorities and our dear friend, Richard Steenen. Back to wrap things up on the Internet Advisor in just a moment.
Back to the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
Well, thank you very much for sticking around with us here on the Internet Advisor for a highfalutin conversation. Richard Steenen is with us. He is the chief research analyst at IT Harvest and a published author and a good friend of ours, an international speaker on cybersecurity. And we've been talking about highfalutin finance with Bitcoin and blockchain, as well as talking about some of the new companies that have risen up. I want to underline something you said, Richard, before in the middle of our conversation, and it was kind of offhanded, but you're saying that if you had a Windows platform laptop or computer, the combination of security that you choose would be Malwarebytes and Microsoft Security Essentials?
Yep, okay. That will do it.
Or the Defender for Windows 10.
Defender. That, in other words, Defender, what you get with Windows 10, right?
Yeah, the free stuff, yeah. I can't tell you how many people I went to in the last 2 weeks and got rid of their McAfee that was prompting them to purchase it. And they're running Windows 10. And I'm like, uninstall the McAfee, and Microsoft Windows Defender will assert itself and protect you.
Microsoft is there. Yep. Which brings to mind an interesting conversation I had this week. So I talked to the founder of a company called Polyverse, and, Skype conversations with full video. And all of a sudden, this guy is explaining how he was the technology advisor to Bill Gates at Microsoft during... during the tumultuous, 2000 to 2003 timeframe when MS Blaster and Melissa and all those worms were just destroying their reputation for security.
Mm.
And he's the one who came up with this idea of, he didn't invent it, but he's pushing forward the Polyverse thing that I described in the last segment.
Yeah. Wow. That is fascinating. Go ahead.
Yeah. I immediately realized, he had the right experience to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
So there's another cool company just north of us here in Detroit, 3 miles up or 3 hours drive to Cambridge, Ontario, called eCentire. And as you might know, Gary, you remember, I left Rustnet to join Netrex, one of the first managed security service providers. And that whole industry is all about managing people's firewalls and intrusion detection systems and logging, right? And it's a frustrating business to observe from the outside because they don't really add any value. They just offload your requirement from various compliance regimes to log everything and alert on stuff, right? But if you're setting up alerts in the security world today, you're getting tens of thousands, possibly every hour, and you just can't filter through them all and understand what to do. So eCentire came at it about 10 years ago, and he said, look, we're not going to do that stuff. We're going to put a sensor on your network. We're going to watch your network traffic. And when we see things that are unusual, outside the realm of the normal behavior, we're going to kill them. So they do TCP/IP resets. They shun attacks. So finally, there's a company out there, I call it MSSP 3.0, that actually does security for you. So you sign these guys up, and at the last company that I just left, that was the first thing I did when I was put in charge of security, was reach out to them and say, I need it, all five offices, deploy a sensor, and give us this real-time eyes on glass, people in their office in Cambridge and Cork, Ireland now, are stopping attacks. And they've got customers that will say, wow, these guys saved our entire company when somebody clicks on the wrong link, they get their machine infected, you can immediately tell the machine starts doing things that's abnormal, and then they just cut off its access to the internet and the rest of the network.
It's like having an IT department that's your own IT department focused on security.
I remember in the early days, Novell Networks had the same relationship with McAfee. So if a computer became infected, the McAfee software would notify the server, and the server would block any further communications to that client years ago. I mean, this was in the 90s, and this is just the next evolution to that. Yeah.
Excellent. Yep, excellent. Exactly. There was one other one out there, and we were running out of time here. I want to make sure you talk about, was it called Verodin?
Yeah, Verodin is, when I heard their pitch, I was like, wow, you guys are new. You're really doing something that I've never seen before. So there's this idea of penetration testing, right? So you're supposed to go out and hire a firm. They basically scan your network for vulnerabilities. And in some cases, they'll actually try and exploit those vulnerabilities and get access to something on the inside of your network. So very expensive. It can cost $10,000 to $50,000. When I was at PwC, we charged $90,000 to do this.
Wow.
But that was PwC. Of course, you got to pay a lot. And there's an industry already around that.
Mm-hmm.
These guys talk about doing, full-on testing of your security procedures. And the way they do it is they deploy what they call actors on the inside, which are just virtual machines that look like your regular computers or servers. And then they deploy actors on the outside in the cloud, and they've got thousands of attacks. And they run the attacks from the outside actors to the inside actors, and they monitor what gets reported to your logging systems like SIEM.
That's interesting.
And they'll say, hey, we just executed a completely successful attack of, whatever, wannabe or some ransomware attack, and nothing detected it. So you've got a problem. And Or they show me all these test cases where it was detected, but nobody had written a correlation rule in their SIEM, their Security Information Event Management System, to alert on it. So... Yeah, they got a log that's
fascinating.
Fascinating. Blown away.
Richard, we're down to about a minute of time with you. What's in the future for you?
So I'm jumping both feet back into the consulting business. So left my job a week ago, and I've already just reach out to a bunch of friends, and they say, oh, my gosh, we can use you. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah, yeah. You're like Mr. Gary Baker there, never out of a job in that sense.
And Gary, I wasn't desperate because I didn't call you, because I would have.
and usually I call you, so.
Yeah.
It's a mutual admiration society. Richard, Stephen, thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to having you on the air again soon.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Great to talk to you.
And Mr. Gary Baker, good talking to you down there in Florida. Hope you have a great week.
Same to you, and same to everyone out there listening.
Smooth sailing, as they say, Gary. Take care. And then, Ed and Cal, thank you so much for being with me here in studio this week. We've got a great week coming up ahead of us, folks. Yeah, look for this podcast on Sunday nights on our internetadvisor.net page. For the rest of the crew here, my name is Foster Brown, wishing you a very, very good week and a safe one, too. Don't forget to get in touch with us with your questions by going to internetadvisor.net and sending us an email.